Summer School at the Seneca Gray Shirt, Wednesday morning, 15th April 1981. I am very glad to see you all for our last talk this year. And especially, I would like to welcome Sister Winifred for being so kind as to be present here. I think it will be best if first we summed up all that we have been considering in connection with our theme on living humanly. The first and the most important point for us ordinary people in the world, where living humanly is concerned, is the observance of the moralities, the ethical life. This is the indispensable foundation for any sort of human fulfillment. To start with, a human fulfillment which ends in a divine fulfillment, actually. Our potentiality is divine. Recall those wonderful words of Meister Eckhart. They occur in the collection of Sermons and Collations, 75, number 4, entitled Hindrances. And he says there, unequivocally, "For man is truly God, and God is truly man." And if one studies Eckhart carefully, one will see what a remarkable correspondence there is between Eckhart's conception of the origin of things and development and so forth, and the sort of teachings that we have in Hinduism and Buddhism on this matter. So now, ethical living is the most essential point for human living. And the second is to live constantly, constantly in the state of self-recollection. You remember again Jesus' words, "Watch and pray, for ye know neither the hour nor the day when the Son of Man cometh." And the Son of Man, man derived from man, from which our word mind is also derived. The Son of Mind comes. That means that our true sense of transcendence awakens. And he said, watch. And that watchfulness, it has to be constant. You have in the Buddha's teaching the counterpart to watch and pray. And as you know, the Buddha flourished 5 centuries before the birth of Christ. He taught in the Noble Eightfold Path, the 2 final steps as they are called. But all the steps actually have to be lived simultaneously. And those 2 steps are Samā Sati, perfect mindfulness, and Samā Samādhi, perfect communion. Samadhi really in fulfillment is the supreme togetherness where we have utterly freed ourselves from that sinful consciousness which isolates us as separate beings from the rest of the universe. The fact of the one totality, the one total reality as a perfect harmony is expressed in that word samadhi, which I always like to translate as communion. Communion in the supreme sense, in complete consciousness. You can appreciate the importance of this if you look carefully at that verse in Genesis, for instance. In the cool of the evening, the Lord God walks in the garden and inquires, "Adam, where art thou?" Is it conceivable that the all-seeing one, the omniscient one, needed to ask, Adam, where art thou? A mortal creature, where art thou? But supposing, that is to say, physically, as a person, but supposing the real meaning is, where are you in your innermost consciousness? Have you not, the implication being, have you not fallen from the state of supreme communion with me, the supreme being? I think that if we look at it that way, we shall have much enlightenment. So you see, one sees the importance of perfect mindfulness all along the line. Most of our the trouble we bring upon ourselves and upon others, worse still, is due to being unmindful. We confess that when we say, I didn't know what I was doing. Well, why not? What were you thinking of? Where was your attention? If your attention is upon the things that do not conduce to communion, then we are still in the subhuman state. And also, one can say, we are not good animals. Our animalishness has been degraded to the level of bestiality. That is why we are unmindful, subhuman. But mindfulness is essential, therefore, for the release of the whole psychophysical being from all the difficulties that limit us and hold us imprisoned in the state of worldliness. The true human is free of worldliness. He is free of all selfness. The true human is the selfless being. And do remember that selflessness is not the same as just unselfishness, which is one dual in that of which the other dual is selfishness. And therefore, if we try to live only in terms of duality and have the imposed relative ethic of unselfishness which must be practiced, then the psyche is perpetually in a state of conflict. And in the state of conflict, one cannot release harmony, fullness of being. As a psychophysical, complete individual human being, indivisible. Individual means indivisible. And then from that stage we come to the third, which brings us to the culmination of our humanness as such. The stage where we, through mindfulness essentially, and through the constant living of the ethical life, we are able to enter into that state of awareness of transcendence perpetually here. We always say, in Him we live and move and have our being. We say that the Supreme is omnipresent. But do we behave in thought and feeling, in word and deed, as if the Supreme were present here and now? Do we behave like that? Or do we time and again disturb the peace of nature and of God by our intrusiveness, our self-intrusiveness and our self-obtrusiveness? So we have to bear all these things carefully in mind. And the practice of meditation, which in another form is contemplative prayer. To put it in another form, contemplative prayer, the practice of meditation by the individual, is absolutely essential in order that our true destiny as human beings can come to fulfillment. You will find this brought out in the Upanishads. You will also find it in Genesis, the implication of that verse in the first chapter, towards the end of the first chapter. And Elohim said, let us, now this is my translation, it's slightly different as far as the English is concerned. And Elohim said, let us create man in our own living likeness. I prefer that to the ordinary translation one finds often. And Elohim said, let us make man in our image. To create man is something very different from making man. And an image is very different from a living likeness. An image is a fossil. There is no growth, there is no progress involved in it. So, we must bear that in mind because it definitely indicates what our potential is and how it may be brought to fruition. So, those three aspects, the ethical life, the mindfulness, and the state of communion, which is realized through the constant contemplative prayer or meditation in the true sense. Do realize that the English word meditation in the dictionary is given as musing or thinking about some serious topic, particularly a religious topic. Our thinking is impotent. The thought in the mind of God, as put in the writings of Hermes Trismegistus, the Hellenistic formulation of original Egyptian teachings, the thought in the mind of God is a creative power. That is why I like to see in chapter 1 of Genesis, not the translation, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. When we say said, we think in terms of ourselves making symbolical sounds in our own language to represent external reality. What language did God speak? Hebrew? Sanskrit? Pali? French? Or English? He didn't speak any such language. He is the creative power. God is the creative power itself. The unborn, the unbecome, the unmade. That transcendent void which holds the total plenitude in potentiality within itself and puts it forth when it is the divine will to put it forth. So, we must realize these things in our everyday life, and that is important. It's so easy to be devout and feel holy and feel perhaps smugly conscious of one's own goodness and holiness. It is all very well to do that on one day of the week and then on the remaining 6 days behave towards man as if he was not what he is actually. Transcendence embodied. All right. Now in this connection, there is considerable analytical presentation of the deep states of consciousness in all the mysticisms of the world, and this sort of presentation is perhaps most expressed in great detail in the Buddhist scriptures. You all have heard, I think, of the Prajna Paramita Sutra, the discourse. Prajna Paramita. Paramita means an excellence, the perfection. And Prajna means insight, divine insight, the unerring insight of the perfected Holy One. So this is the excellent, perfect wisdom. That excellence which is the perfect wisdom, the unerring insight, so that you are conscious permanently of the truth as such. The truth which utterly transcends any possibility of expression in our ordinary conceptualizing and verbalizing. It is important to bear this in mind. And if through our own practice and our own development, and especially through the awakening, even the first simple awakenings of our sense of transcendence, we look into this sutra, we shall find extraordinary truth. It is called the Heart Sutra. The Prajnaparamita, of course, is a collection of many, many verses, and they have been expanded in the early centuries. It extends from about the 2nd century before Christ to about the 2nd or 3rd century after Christ. And it has been expressed in short forms and in long forms. There is an 8,000 verses form, there is a 100,000 verses form. But we need only deal with the few verses which we can possibly tackle, because they are very deep and they are very difficult indeed. It is called the Heart Sutra. In the Sanskrit, Hridaya Sutta. Now, Hridaya is a word which means the physical heart, the heart inside the body. That is its ordinary everyday meaning. But Hridaya means heart also in the sense in which we use it in the English language, when we say that the heart of the matter is this. In other words, it is the essence, it is the supreme essence. Hridaya stands for the supreme essence as such. So now here is this particular set of verses which deals with this supreme essence. And remember, I have already said, these things defy conceptualizing and verbalizing. So then you'll say, why read anything at all about it? For this very simple reason, that the spoken word is capable of reflecting, howsoever faintly, and suggesting, howsoever gently, that which is the transcendent reality. If you are in the state of full attention, and both mind and heart are utterly pure, in that moment of grace, you will thrill inwardly in your innermost depth of consciousness to what might be implied in words like these. It starts, as those of you who have already studied it already know, with the sentence, homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. It's a very interesting juxtaposition. The lovely, the beautiful, the holy. Holiness and beauty. And one is reminded up to a point of Plato's fundamental ideas, the supreme, the archetypal ideas. Truth, goodness, you can equate goodness with holiness, and beauty. And in Sanskrit and Pali, they always use this word, which is usually translated as the lovely. It runs like this. Avalokita, the holy Lord and Bodhisattva, was moving in the deep course of the wisdom which has gone beyond. Avalokita literally means he who looks down upon. But the term looks down is not used in a pejorative sense, but in the sense of something which is distant and it is far away. And you are seeing it from far away. Here, of course, in terms of consciousness, pure consciousness, functioning at its own transcendent level, not at our ordinary human level, which is dependent upon sense, the operation of our senses and the brain activity of logical, discursive thought. And the full name is Avalokiteshvara. Now you have this this suffix Eshvara added to Avalokita. Avalokita, he who looks down, and Eshvara is the Sanskrit Ishvara, which is practically the exact equivalent of the theistic religions who talk of God as the personal being, the supreme personal excellence, the supreme perfection as a being. So when you get Avalokiteshvara, it means here was one who was able to look at that which is the manifested thing with the vision of a divine being. You find the same when the Upanishads talk of Yajnavalkya, who was one of the greatest of the Upanishadic teachers. He is referred to as Yogeshwara. He was the divine yogi. I said a few things about him yesterday in connection with moving to the Aditya realm, which meant the realm of the sun, which typifies the completely illuminated state and so forth. All these things happen in consciousness, in mind and consciousness. So the holy Avalokita, the holy Lord and Bodhisattva. Bodhisattva means literally the wisdom being, a wisdom being, he who is the embodied wisdom. Sattva, wisdom, Bodhi, wisdom, Sattva, a being. The Pali form is Satta, not Sattva. Was moving in the deep course of the wisdom which has gone beyond. This refers to practically the supreme meditative condition, where the meditator is in perfect communion with the divine itself. The wisdom which has gone beyond. And that means that is a wisdom which we ordinary mortals, at least I as an ordinary mortal, cannot possibly think about. It is, as they say in Sanskrit, achintya, unthinkable. It is unspeakable. It is beyond all things. Now, he looked down from on high. He beheld but five heaps, and he saw that in their own being they were empty. The five heaps refer to the psychophysical organism as such. You know the Buddhist analysis of the psychophysical person here on earth is in terms of rupa, shape or form, that is mostly not only bodily form, remember, but also your thought forms, the forms which are taken up by your feelings, your ideas and all that sort of thing. All these are shapes, they are forms, they are crystallizations of that which in its essentiality is utterly free and void of all limitation. So he looks down upon this psychophysical organism, which is composed of the five heaps, as they are called, shape or form, sensation, vedana, feeling, the thoughts, the ideas, the thought patterns, the confections, as they are called, the sankhara, in our own brains. and our discriminative consciousness. Now, this is one of the very valuable contributions which was made by Buddhist teaching, distinguishing discriminative consciousness from consciousness which is transcendent. Transcendent consciousness is not discriminative because in actuality it is the totality itself. You remember, was it yesterday or day before, I mentioned that pure consciousness and the primordial creative energy are an identity. They are not separate things. And he saw that this which is the expression of mortality and is ruled by the Lord of Death ultimately is utterly empty. It's utterly empty of any permanent entity or immortal, separate immortal being as such. The psychophysical organism perishes, completely perishes. That in their own being they were empty. And he goes on, here, O Shariputta, meaning at this transcendent level, form is emptiness. Now this is something which needs lots of meditation, and one can also have lots of exposition and explanation in association with it. Form here is the, as put in other scriptures, the thought in the mind of God. The thought is a form, it's a shape. But this shape, this form, has creative power. And it represents what is put in scriptures as the Word, the Divine Word, which brings into being all manifestation. So that is the form. But the form as such is empty. What is it empty of? It is empty of all that constitutes ill, evil. In a single sentence, whatsoever separates or tends to separate any body or anything from unity of the whole universe, that is the ill state. And that is why in Buddhist philosophy, all existence has been called the ill state, because existence, existere, to stand out of. What is it that the whole of existence stands out of? It stands out of the ultimate origin of all things, this primordial creative energy, this pure absolute consciousness. So form at that transcendent level is empty of all ill. And the very emptiness is form. This is where the marvel comes in, the paradox. I won't try to explain that paradox here and now, or suggest any thoughts which might be helpful, because it would take up far too much time. On some other occasion we might go into it. Emptiness does not differ from form. The void holds the plenitude in potentiality. The emptiness holds all form at all levels, the transcendent level as well as the ultimate expression in terms of complete concreteness, the material level as we call it. It holds all that in potentiality, and hence they are treated as an identity. Emptiness does not differ from form, nor does form differ from emptiness. Whatever is form, that is emptiness. Whatever is emptiness, that is form. Remember that the word emptiness finishes its scope when the transcendent itself is realized. Transcendence itself is not empty, it is the absolute all. But emptiness enters into the situation the moment you get the first thrill of creative activity. That first thrill of creative activity, there is a form produced, the thought in the divine mind, as we say, as we can say. Nor does form differ from emptiness. Whatever is form, that is emptiness. Whatever is emptiness, that is form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. This is vijnana, remember, discriminative consciousness. All this is form, and it is also empty, a vast emptiness. It's one of the very remarkable things in the development of science in our modern world, especially in this century, that scientists discovered that there is no ultimate, concrete, original matter as such. The whole thing is an empty. The spaces between the nucleus of an atom, to confine ourselves to the atomic level and not to enter into the subatomic level, which is even more remarkable. The spaces between the nucleus and the surrounding electrons are simply tremendous compared with the actual material content, so to say, inside the nucleus. An atom, therefore, in the early part of this century, I remember hearing in Trinity in Cambridge, Sir J.J. Thomson himself, I attended his lectures, and Rutherford, they spoke about the atom which as being comparable to a solar system. However large the sun is, still as the nucleus of the solar system, and compared with the distances of the planets, with empty space, as we think, between the sun and the planets, is like this atom. So, it's a vast emptiness. The whole of the psychophysical organism is this emptiness, hence its mortality. Here, O Sariputra. Sariputta was, as you know, one of the foremost disciples of the Buddha. All dharmas in this context means ultimate essences. All dharmas are marked with emptiness. They are neither produced nor stopped, neither defiled nor immaculate, neither deficient nor complete. This is a tremendous statement, and it has been the source of much, I was going to say heart-burning, but I should, it would be better to say more head-burning for many, many philosophers indeed. I mean, these statements are so difficult to for us to penetrate into their inner meaning. Therefore, O Sariputta, where there is emptiness, there is, now listen very carefully, because this refers to our psychophysical being and all our philosophies which have been spun out out of the examination of the psychophysical being. Therefore, O Sariputta, where there is emptiness, there is neither form, nor feeling, nor perception, nor impulse, nor consciousness. There is no eye, or ear, or nose, or tongue, or body, or mind. No form, no sound, nor smell, nor taste, nor touchable, nor object of mind. You see the implication of statements like that. That in the very deep meditative states, and all the great mystics of the world touch this, in this deep meditative state, all that we are accustomed to as being the real, and we talk of the eternal hills and the eternal stars and so forth. But none of them are eternal. They are all mortal. They are all temporal. So in this state of consciousness, you are aware of the unreality, so to say, the mortality of everything that is manifested, everything that we in the ordinary course of our lives experience. He goes on, no sight organ, no hearing organ, no taste organ, etc. The whole lot are non-existent in that state of communion. No mind consciousness element. Here, of course, referring to discriminative consciousness. There is no ignorance here, nor extinction of ignorance. Because if there is no ignorance, obviously there need not be any extinction of ignorance. And so forth. Until we come to, there is no decay and death. Here is the affirmation of the eternal and the immortal in negative terms. And that those are the best terms in which we can try to talk about eternity or immortality. There is no decay and death. No extinction of decay and death. Here, when we try to live the spiritual life, we are trying to realize the conquest of death, as we might call it. But there is no such thing as the conquest of death. Death, as I have so strongly insisted, I take full responsibility for it, is other life. But you must realize that death is not other life in the sense that it is my other life. Wheresoever that wretched adjective, my, or is it a pronoun? Pronoun? Yes. Wherever that wretched, those wretched adjectives, my and mine, come in, there we are setting ourselves against the supreme divine reality. There is so this other life is not my other life by any manner or means. It is the indescribable, the supreme thing, the total unity. For God got, and especially if you study Eckhart, you will appreciate this very much. The distinction between Gottheit and God. God, as we would say, is that which emerges out of that unknown origin. Unknown and unknowable. And therefore, we are as nothing before that Gottheit. But God, since God is evolved as an entity out of Gottheit, therefore God becomes the originator of all other manifestation. And the whole idea of the Trinity and so forth. And here you'll find complete correspondences in all the great religions. Except in Zarathustrianism, which doesn't present the idea of a trinity, but of a septenary. There is no extinction of decay and death. There is no suffering, no origination, nor stopping, nor a path to perfection. There is no cognition, there is no attainment, and no non-attainment. Now, those of you who have studied your Buddhism carefully, the Buddhist presentation of the deep states of consciousness, know that it is presented as the first four jhanas, as they are called, and then they are followed by four samapattis. The dictionary gives a rather inadequate definition of samapatti. They talk of samapatti as attainment, but I think that is downright folly. Because these attainments are supposed to take place in terms of the infinity of akasha, vijnana, the no-thing, the neither perception nor non-perception, and the final state of the complete plunge into the Supreme as such. How can you attain the infinite? I, a finite being, entering deep states of consciousness, how can I attain anything like the infinite? The infinite already holds me completely and totally. So you don't attain anything. But there is another meaning which the Sanskritists give to samapatti. It means coalescence. Now here you can really get hold of something which is worthwhile. The finite limited mind and the limited consciousness coalesce with the infinite mind and consciousness, the infinite totality, you see. And there you have some sort of real meaning. So don't think in terms of any attainment. There is no such thing as attainment for us mortals. We are just mortals as such. If we get free of the passion to attain some wonderful spiritual status or something, well, we might end up in the company of Lucifer. Therefore, O Sariputta, owing to a bodhisattva's indifference to any kind of personal attainment. Now, this word indifference, it doesn't mean indifference in our sense that, oh, we don't care tuppence for that. You see, it's not indifference in that sense. It means actually equanimity, that state of equanimity where you do not grasp at anything, where you do not reject anything. You just allow the universe to be the universe as it is. It is that state of supreme and superb equanimity which is referred to here. Owing to a bodhisattva's indifference to any kind of personal attainment. And what a wonderful way to manifest true humility. You don't have to strive for it. You naturally are like that. Spontaneously, therefore, and quite naturally, there is true humility. And in that true humility only, there is the possibility of communion with the Supreme. Indifference to any kind of personal attainment, and through his having relied on the perfection of wisdom. This perfection of wisdom is not something which is an acquisition by the perfected Holy One. It is no acquisition. It is his natural constitution. These great spiritual values like truth, love, beauty, goodness, purity, and so on, they are constitutive of our divine nature. They themselves constitute divine being, if you like to put it in those terms. And through his having relied on the perfection of wisdom, he dwells without thought coverings. That means to say, he lives in that state of transcendent awareness without conceptualizing and verbalizing. We, when we communicate with each other at our level, at our ordinary human level, the level not of the true, the fulfilled Son of Man, who is also the Son of God, not at that level, but our ordinary subhuman level, I should say, then we produce thought coverings. We cover up whatsoever our inner vision really perceives with in the form of ideas, thoughts, and words. We conceptualize everything. And all conceptualizing and verbalizing is limiting. Every one of it, every bit of it. He dwells without thought coverings. In the absence of thought coverings, he has not been made to tremble. Now you might wonder, why this idea of tremble? Why does the perfected Holy One tremble? Why does he fear? Recall that sentence in the beginning, in the Old Testament, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. What is this fear? This fear is a state of spiritual apprehensiveness. You don't know just what is going to happen. You just don't know. You can't imagine it. And you mustn't try to imagine it, otherwise it will never happen. Because this communion with the divine is something so extraordinary, so overwhelming, and yet so life-giving that one naturally trembles before it happens. It is that kind of fear. It's like that sense of fear which the beloved experiences when approaching the consummation of love with the beloved. If there has been purity before that, not otherwise. He has overcome what can upset. In the end, sustained by nirvana. The literal meaning of the word nirvana is blown out, extinction. What is the mean? What is the extinction here? You know that scholars write up, even towards the end of the last century, completely misrepresented nirvana as annihilation. This is, nothing could have been more false. It is the state of the extinction of all ill. When through the disciplines, the ethical life, the mindfulness, and the meditation and the contemplative prayer and so forth, your full humanness is released, then that which is the utterly transcendent, nirvana, which is totally devoid of all ill, that manifests through you. You never reach or attain nirvana or the kingdom of heaven. But the kingdom of heaven or nirvana comes and fills you and manifests through you to the world around you. And thereby you become a benediction wheresoever you live. You are, to put it in other terms, you are a savior, one who salves, one who heals completely, restores himself and everything around him to the state of the original holiness, which was lost in the Adam and Eve story. That is a story which is enacted constantly throughout our lives, in every one of us. It didn't happen just once. It is happening throughout the whole history of mankind. Then that original Eden is once again re-established, but with a difference. Whereas the first Adam, in the sinless state, was naturally and inevitably perfect and pure, he conversed with God. Now, you and I ordinarily don't converse with God. Why should Adam have been allowed that privilege? It was just unconsciously so. The whole purpose of human evolution is that we, going through all that we go through, will consciously and skillfully be cooperators with the divine in the whole process of our evolution and development. This is the raison d'etre of going through the fall. The fall had to come. It was necessary to bring it about in order that ultimately man will be the conscious cooperator with the divine. That is to say, he will be the holy grail in his own psychophysical personal being, into which the divine energy, the transcendent energy, flows freely and flows out freely again. And it ends thus: all those who appear as Buddhas in the three periods of time, past, present, future, that is, they all fully awaken to the utmost right and perfect enlightenment, because they have relied on the perfection of wisdom. Now do realize that whilst wisdom is emphasized here, it has been clearly taught both in the Upanishads and in the Buddhist teachings and in the other religions too. In the Zarathustra's Gathas too, you will find it. This wisdom does not exist apart from transcendent love. Transcendent love and wisdom are an identity practically. Wisdom is the consciousness aspect. Transcendent wisdom. Transcendent love is the actual practical aspect. It is manifest straight away. If you are truly conscious, as I tried to suggest yesterday, was it, or on Monday, I forget which. If you are truly conscious of love, then you never have to think about love. You will naturally and spontaneously, inevitably, constantly express love through all your thought and feeling, through your words and your deeds. You see, that's what consciousness really means. Pure consciousness. We are just discriminatively conscious. And by being discriminatively conscious, that of which we are conscious, although we may call it a profound truth or a profound idea or whatever it is external to us. We are conscious of that as the idea, the statement. But when that has become internal to you, you are love. You don't have to love, or you don't have to be wise. You are love, you are wisdom, even as the divine is perfect love and perfect wisdom and holiness. Therefore, one should know the prajna paramita, the perfection of wisdom, as the great spell, the unequal spell, the utmost spell, the allayer of all suffering. In truth, for what could go wrong when you are utterly purified and have fulfilled the state of holiness as such and communion? For what could go wrong? By the prajna paramita has this spell been delivered. It runs like this. Gate, gate, paragate, parasangate, bodhiswaha. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone altogether beyond, right into the transcendent. What an awakening. All hail. That is the usual translation given. I think we could also translate it rather more literally. All hail to the supreme wisdom. Bodhi is wisdom. You see? So that is the Prajna Paramita, the Hridaya Sutta, as far as I can present it for your consideration. It's a wonderful sutta, but you have to have considerable background, knowledge, experience, and the practice of the discipline of the religious life, which you must choose yourself. And do bear in mind that whilst one starts with conforming to a discipline which is laid down, the ultimate discipline is through your own living being. You are the truth, the way, and the life. All the great teachers made that pronouncement. I am the truth, the way, the life. It's not exclusive to the Christian pronouncement. All the great teachers have said that sort of thing. You'll find it in the Gita, distinctly stated, you see, and so forth. Just to give you one example. So, through your own living being will come the ultimate vision and the ultimate realization, because transcendence itself is embodied in each and every one of us human beings. Elohim minded, let us create man in our living likeness, and that living likeness will be fully manifest in the world. You'll be lights unto the world thereby. Thank you.